Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on American Freedom Radio for the listening pleasure of the Five Eyes Network, who work in concert to make sure everybody gets surveilled, because it's illegal to surveil your own citizens, but it ain't illegal to surveil everybody else's and share your frickin' information. Now, my very special guest joining me today from the fjords of Finland is Ed Dutton. Ed, welcome to the program.
Oh, hello, thank you for having me.
Would you please give the audience a little bit of a background about who you are and what it is you do, kind sir?
I'm a researcher. I mainly research psychology. I'm an adjunct professor at the University of Oulu here in northern Finland, which is just an honorary position, really. And so I'm mainly, I suppose, what you call an independent scholar, really. I'm reliant on people who fund me to do the kind of controversial research that I'm afraid you can no longer do in academia because it's been taken over by certain interest groups. And so that's what I mainly do. And I'm particularly interested in intelligence and various other subjects. I don't know. It's just something about it. If you're told that you're not allowed to research it and it's bad to research it and it's evil to research it, then for some reason it attracts me. So I don't know what it is. There's a contrarian in me. So
either that or you're a fan of Voltaire and you're trying to find out who really controls you.
Well, yes. So I'm afraid I'm quite interested in those kinds of areas. And yeah, and I'm from Britain, obviously, you can probably hear. And I did a doctorate in religious studies in Scotland, and then I moved to, I met a Finnish girl, it's often the way, it's often the way if you come here. And I then moved here and then got a house and a cat and two children. And although I was promised a dog if we had two children, if the two children went well, but the dog never materialised, alas. But yes, and so that's it. And so that's pretty much me.
Yeah.
And I've never been to New Zealand, unfortunately. My only contact with it is a very good English teacher I have, and I was at secondary school called Miss Douglas. But that's it.
I had a very good English teacher called Miss Aldridge. But in either case, getting into the prospect of intelligence, the Jolly Heretic is your handle. Why is that?
Well, people tell me that I talk quite quickly, which I suppose I do, and that I'm a reasonably sort of outgoing sort of a chap. So jolly seemed a good summary. And then heretic, because I'm informed by various people that I'm a scientific heretic. And also when I was a boy, there was a very nice pub in Winchester in the southwest of England where my grandparents were from called the Jolly Farmer, which I liked a great deal. And so those things came together and it became the Jolly Heretic.
That's beautiful, man.
Would be a good name for a pub, I think.
A what?
Good name for a pub.
The Jolly Heretic. Come one and all. Intelligence. This is the reason why I got you on the show today, is I recently had a look at your interview with James Corbett from the Corbett Report, who'd be coming on the show in a couple of weeks' time, actually. And we're talking about this concept of how human intelligence is going down and how there's a lot of actual consequences from that, and indeed it's happened throughout history many, many times. Would you be able to explain that to people?
Well, yes, there's essentially a cycle of intelligence. So societies start off when they're poor under conditions of very, very, very harsh Darwinian selection. And what happens is if you're rich, then you survive. There's essentially the survival of the richest. If you are able to provide better resources for your children, if you're better able to provide them with shelter, if you're better able to whatever, then women will also sexually select, by the way, for intelligent men, precisely because intelligent men can better do those things. And so their offspring were more likely to survive. So both at the level of individual and of sexual selection and even group selection, because of two kind of ethnic groups who are essentially extended families, come into conflict, the more intelligent one will tend to win, the wealthier one will tend to win. And so for all these reasons, you have this selection in favour of wealth. And this we can chart, we know this. So we know, first of all, that the mortality rate in the West until about 1800 was about 40%. But it wasn't 40% from the top to the bottom of society. It was enormous at the bottom of society, about 80% or something, and it was relatively small at the top. And what that meant was that there was a substantial advantage in terms of passing on your genes to being rich. And being rich correlates with being how rich you are correlates with your intelligence at about 0.4. Now, of course, you know, everybody knows of the stereotype of the kind of nerd that's in Mensa and he doesn't earn much money and he just spends all this time learning decks of cards off by heart or whatever, you know. And it's people like that which are the reason why the correlation is only about 0.4. But still, that is a robust correlation. And so what it means is that every single generation, the people at the bottom of society were dying off because they were being selected against because they weren't very intelligent, and the people at the top of society were passing on their genes. And indeed, there were studies in East Anglia, in the east of England, which looked at wills in the late 16th and 17th century. And it divided the testators, which about 60% of men, I think it was it 40% of men, but it was a significant proportion of society, left wills at the time. And they divided the testators into the richer 50% and the poorer 50%. And the richer 50% had a fertility advantage of 40%. And then they took other parish records, the parish records, so births, marriages and deaths, and this meant the burials. And this meant that they were able to broaden, you know, that you had the whole society divided between rich and poor, and the richer 50% has a fertility advantage of 100%. So obviously, and also we've got, so obviously what was happening is that the rich were surviving. There was what this, there's a British psychologist based in America, who Greg Clark, who calls it the survival of the richest. The rich were surviving, the rich were passing on their genes, and what that meant was the intelligent were surviving. So our intelligence was going up. And in our book, if I can plug it, At Our Wit's End, Why We're Becoming Less Intelligent and What It Means for the Future, which was published in November, we can chart it across time. We can actually show, if you look at, I mean, the standard of living between the medieval period and about 1800, there's not much difference. There's a slight improvement, perhaps, but there's not really much difference. But even so, markers of intelligence are going up across time. People are becoming more literate across the period. People are becoming more numerate. People are becoming more likely to know their birthdays, more likely to be able to sign their names. Interest rates are going down. And one of the correlates of intelligence is low time preference. This idea that if you say to somebody, here's one marshmallow, you can have that now, or I'll come back in 5 minutes and you can have two. And the more intelligent child will always wait the 5 minutes. He has longer time horizons. And interest rates, if interest rates are long, it means you've got to have a massive amount of money to make up for the short-term feeling of unpleasantness, as it were. If interest rates are small, then that means intelligence is going up. And so there are all these various other markers, and they all go up. And oh, genius as well, per capita genius. So we can look at the rate of per capita very important innovations. And these go up and up and up from the medieval period until about 80. We can track it across. Also, levels of cruelty go down. Cruelty correlates with low IQ. And we can track it up through time to about 1800. And then you have the Industrial Revolution, and then it falls apart. So this is, and this happens with every society. Now, the difference is that with ancient Greece and ancient Rome and so on, they developed contraception, which is normally the big factor in intelligence going down. Because once you develop contraception, the more intelligent have higher impulse control, they're less inclined to just have sex because they feel like it, they're better able to use contraception correctly. You know, I mean, do you take the pill at the same time every day as you're supposed to, or do you knock it back with a glass of nice white wine when you can remember, you know. And also they are aware that they're wealthy, and so they don't feel the need to have lots of children. They suspect that they won't need to. You know, a lot of their kids will survive. And so they start using contraception first, and then it trickles down the society. And the result of that, of course, is that intelligence starts to go down and the society goes backwards. The difference with us is that for various reasons, contraception didn't get developed until after we'd made the breakthrough of the Industrial Revolution. And that's there's other reasons as well why IQ is going down, but this is the big one, contraception. Because now intelligence is negatively associated with how many children you have, and indeed how many generations you have.
So essentially, back in the day, if you're intelligent, you'd have a lot of kids, whereas if you weren't, a lot of your kids would die. And nowadays, the kids that you had would survive, whereas if you were poor, the kids that you had would often die. So that meant that the more intelligent would survive, whereas nowadays it's very close to the Idiocracy monologue, where it speaks of the people with less intelligence not using contraception, essentially breeding out of control, not entirely dissimilar to how rabbits would breed out of control and just destroy an entire area kind of thing, like the growth of a virus, more or less.
Yes, this is it. So what happens is, first of all, the Industrial Revolution sets off this process. Now, what this process means is, first of all, you get inoculations. Inoculations mean that 40% child mortality, and it's massively among the less intelligent. And the child mortality is massively reduced among the less intelligent. So people with low IQ, who in the old days would have died of typhus and measles and whatever, they're now surviving and they're passing on their low intelligence to their offspring. And at the same time that's happening, the more intelligent people, they're inoculated as well, but they're having fewer children because they're using contraception. So this is the first thing, that contraception doesn't start being taken up in any significant way by the working class till about the 1880s, 1890s, really. So if you go back into genealogy or whatever, you will see this. You will see that working class families, where the father's born about 1880, will often have maybe six kids. They don't need to. I mean, those kids are all going to survive, but there's a lag. They haven't quite computed it yet, but they don't need to. Whereas the upper class will have smaller numbers. So this is the first problem, then, that this negative correlation is caused by. It's caused by a better medicine, and it's caused by contraception. Another factor is feminism. So it's perhaps noticeable that if you go to school, and the girl who's not very bright, she drops out of school at about 16 or something. She has a series of flings with unsuitable blokes. And she's pregnant at 17, 18. She's often, a grandmother by the time she's maybe 38. And this is the time when her more intelligent contemporaries, who've dedicated all of their 20s and increasingly even the first half of their 30s to their careers, are beginning to think about having children. So the consequence of this is not only that there is a 0.2 negative correlation between intelligence in women and how many kids they have, and that the most intelligent women, by the way, don't have any kids at all. Often they leave it too late, or they're very high in sort of intellect and they think having kids will damage their career and whatever. And so you get these people like Angela Merkel or whatever that just don't have children. There's a lot of actual significant politicians at the moment in Europe, women politicians who are childless. And so you have not just more children, but more generations. This is the huge thing, more generations. Well, the stupid people are grandparents, by the time the clever people are parents. And so this is pushing IQ down. And then you have welfare and what welfare does. Now, at the moment, there was a very interesting book that was published a few years ago, which was, of course, suppressed by the mainstream media, called The Well, and the guy, the left tried to, he's a university lecturer at King's College London, and the left tried to make life hard for him, a guy called Adam Perkins. And he wrote a very brave book called The Welfare Trait. He also drew upon some research in New Zealand, by the way, on this, somewhere called the Dunder-Din study or something. Forgive me, I can't remember, but there was a lot of research on welfare in New Zealand in his book. Mm. But anyway, I remember on the English research that he showed that if you divide society between the least intelligent families, where both of the parents are on welfare, the middling families, where one parent's on welfare and one's working, and the most intelligent families, where both parents are working, it is only the families where both parents are on welfare that have above replacement fertility. And so, of course, this means that the future is those people. And it should be emphasized that intelligence is 80% genetic. So it's very, very strongly genetic. It's very, very strongly passed on from parents to children. And so, of course, the result of this inevitably is intelligence is in decline. And we've got evidence, clear evidence, which we look at in the book, that it definitely is in decline.
We're sure that it's genetic. What response does the thing here? Because I was using this analogy with somebody one time, as you imagine a warlord who, in Africa, who rapes a prostitute, and then they have she has a child, and then that warlord moves on, essentially, right? And then you have a look at, say, an English piano teacher and a psychologist who have a child and raise that child together. You see two massively different potential for the life of those two individual children, one without parents and one with. One has highly educated parents who are going to be there for them, and one has no educated parents, and they're not going to be there for them at all. And so I wonder what the mitigating factor is. How is the intelligence passed down through raising and that kind of thing?
Well, but it's certainly true that there is about 20. If we know from twin adoption studies that about 20% of the variance is environment, and about 80% of the variance is genetic. Hmm. And what's happened as well? There's this thing called the Flynn effect, which some people may have heard of, which is this idea that Jim Flynn, who is an American psychologist, but he's resident in New Zealand. I forget which university it is in New Zealand. I can check if you want. But anyway, and he has discovered this phenomenon whereby IQ scores have been going up across the 20th century. So this would imply that, of course, we were getting more intelligent across the 20th century. But the problem with it is that the IQ test isn't a perfect measure of intelligence. Yeah. Any more than a scales is a perfect measure of weight.
It's a measure of intellect, and intellect and intelligence are, well, there's seven different forms of intelligence, I believe, or eight, I think.
Well, there's much debate over how many forms of intelligence there are, but often on IQ tests it's reduced to, well, you have a kind of pyramid. And so you talk about specialised abilities, things like how good you are at realising what category something goes in, or something like that, specialised abilities. And then above that, you have mathematical, linguistic and spatial intelligence. And often mathematical intelligence is the most correlated, but then the one that's above that, which is G, general intelligence, which is the core intelligence ability. Now, in individuals, we can talk about this G thing, because in individuals, you get some people that are very good at maths and not that good at writing or whatever. But in general, if you're good at one form of intelligence, you're good at all of them. There are certain variations in that. There are certain outliers where it's a bit peculiar, but like Einstein or something. These people who have super high G are often very rubbish at these specialised abilities. You know, they can't drive a car, they can't catch a ball or something. These things are weakly G loaded.
Indeed, there was a story you told about how Einstein one time got lost in New York City and he went into a shop just saying, "Hi, I'm Einstein. I'm lost. Can you help me get home, please?"
Well, it was worse than that, because I'd imagine getting lost in New York City is easier than getting lost where he lost, which was Princeton, New Jersey. So he got lost in some of the New York. He was deficient. A lot of people that have very high IQ, they can't drive cars. I mean, that's why the Sheldon Cooper stereotype is so wonderfully accurate. He has to get his friend Leonard to drive him to work. Anyway, so going back to the Flynn effect. So what's happening is that the IQ scores are going up. But when it was looked into, it was realised that it wasn't G that was going up. It wasn't general intelligence that was going up. What had happened is that on one of these specialised abilities, i.e. analytic thinking, the ability to put things into boxes, as it were, there had been such a massive rise that it had overwhelmed anything else that was happening with general intelligence or any other form of IQ, and it come across as an overall rise. And it's a little bit like, I don't know, if you imagine height, often the trunk is highly genetic. How big your trunk is strongly genetic. How long your legs are strongly environmental. It's perfectly possible that at a genetic level, you could be getting shorter, but at an environmental level, you're getting taller because of the better nutrition or whatever. And that environmental factor overwhelms the genetic decline, and so you come across as taller. You see? And so eventually, the phenotypic limit for whatever is making you get taller, you know, good food or whatever it happens to be, will be reached. And when that happens, then the underlying genetic decline will come through, and people will start to get shorter. And so it's rather like that with intelligence. We're suggesting that there is a decline in intelligence at the genetic level. It's been overwhelmed by, it's called the co-occurrence model. It's my colleague Michael Woodley's idea. There's a decline at the genetic level. There's a rise at the environmental level that's been set off by what our society has done. Our society has made us more literate. Our society has made us read more. Our society has made us more scientific. And so it's pushed to the phenotypic limit, this particular specialised ability that weakly correlates with intelligence. And that's overwhelmed whatever's happened. Now, in about 1997, based on substantial cohort military data that we have from Scandinavia, where in a lot of these countries, the whole male sample is assessed because everyone has to do military service. They all have an IQ test. And the IQ scores were going up until 1997. And since then, they have started to go down. And the negative Flynn effect, the anti-Flynn effect, this is not on the environmentally sensitive aspects of IQ. This is on the genetically sensitive aspects of IQ. This is a genetic thing. And consistent with that, we have data from Iceland, which shows that across three generations, the percentage of the population that carry polymorphisms, which are associated with very high intelligence, is going down. So this is pretty clear that this is a genetic factor. And we've looked in lots and lots of negative Flynn effects from lots and lots of countries. And in most cases, it's demonstrated that this is a consequence of the more of G. G is highly genetic, the core intelligence ability of G going down. So there are people that have other theories and they say it's to do, there's a woman in France called Barbara Demenou who reckons it's to do with endocrine disruptors and things like this. But the evidence is against that. The evidence is that it's highly genetic. However, it would then have if it, in, G is going down, it would have an environmental knock-on effect, as you highlight with your Somali warlord thing, because it would mean if we were getting less intelligent, we'd be less able to create good schools and to create environments that were conducive to pushing our analytical ability, as it were, to its phenotypic limit. And so then for that reason as well, for an environmental reason, ultimately underpinned by a genetic reason, it you'd have a further decline. So you'd end up with this symbiotic snowball of a decline, which would cause societal intelligence to decrease. And there's many other measures on which we've got good evidence for this. IQ scores, reaction time scores, how quickly you react if someone puts a light on or something like that, correlate with intelligence at about 0.3. It's a robust correlation, and these have got longer since 1880. And based on these, it seems that we have lost 15 to 20 IQ points. My colleague did a study called "The Victorians Were Smarter Than Us," and did you drop something? So to put that in perspective, 15 points is the difference between, let's say, a policeman or a fireman or a person, average person, basically, that does a desk job. Not that, I mean, you get clever people that do these things, but on average, this is the IQ of someone that does that kind of job is about 100, which is the average. It's the difference between that person and a school teacher, where the average IQ is about 115. Or it's the difference between the school teacher, where the IQ is about 115, and a university lecturer in, let's say, biology. That's the difference. So obviously that's a substantial difference. The average person in Victorian England would have been capable of being a school teacher by modern standards.
That's interesting, because I think an old Freemason pal of mine, Frederick, he showed me these tests from the late 1880s that they would give to children who were like maybe 7 years old or something like that. And then they tried getting modern children to sit these same tests, and they'd be getting like 1%, 2%, maybe 5% of the questions correct. So the knowledge of the world around us and how we're schooled and things like that has just...
Well, that's an interesting point, actually. I mean, I was some years ago, I was reading my daughter, at that time, was, I don't know how old she was, not eight or something. I was reading her, you know, the Just William books. Written in the 20s, written in the 1920s. And the TV series about it. And I was reading this, and it had words like querulous. Now, that is, I mean, you know, that is a word that a lot of kids of eight are not going to know the meaning of. It means kind of moaningy, you know. It's extraordinary that they would be expected to know these words. If you look at Alice in Wonderland, you will find that the level of linguistic ability that was expected was very high, really, for children. And we've got data on this, and we can trace it across time. And it's been shown that using Google Ngram, you can analyze texts all the way back to the 1500s. And it's based on this, our vocabulary is getting better because we reread more and we learn more words and whatever. But when it comes to using hard words, difficult words, highly technical and specific words, it's getting worse. And this makes sense because an aspect of intelligence is the ability to comprehend the world. And you can better comprehend the world if you can think in a more subtle way. And you can better think in a more subtle way if you have more subtle, as it were, thinking tools. And that's what words are. You know, there are subtle differences between, let's say, I don't know, refute and rebut, which some people of, let's say, 16 will be able to understand and others won't. And so these kinds of things, these high order words. And across time, what we show in the book is that our use of these difficult words was going up from the 1500s to about 1800. And since then, it started to go down. And interestingly, in terms of our vocabulary, in terms of our use of very difficult words, we are back at the level now that we were in about 1700, which is about 100 years before the Industrial Revolution. In terms of per capita genius, so in terms of per capita, inventions that scientists agree are really important breakthrough inventions, right? In terms of those, we were going up from, my colleague has traced it from about 1400 to about 1850, and then we start to go down, and we are back at the level now with per capita inventions, important inventions, that we were in 1600. So when Elizabeth I was on the throne. And think about how much worse the society was then, how much less intellectually stimulating it was. If we return to your very interesting Somali comparison, I mean, England was run by warlords then. England was basically like Somalia. The government barely controlled things outside London. People would all be in kind of gangs, essentially, albeit run by gentlemen. It's probably worse then than that. There are other factors that have changed as well. I mean, there's some evidence that personality has changed, which would have some bearing on things. So we've become more extrovert over time, it seems. People who are extrovert are more likely to pass on their genes. But yeah, in general, so it's quite a serious thing.
Yeah.
Because basically...
Well, there's a number of things that you've said there that I'd like to touch on. One is epigenetics by Bruce Lipton, who says that in the first 7 years of life, approximately 97% of your behaviours that you learn will pretty much be locked in, and you'll act that way for more or less the rest of your life. The second is epigenetics. You'll basically have about 97% of your behaviours locked in by the age of about 7, depending on how you're raised, that kind of thing, and it'll be very difficult to change those behaviours. This is why everybody goes, oh no, I'm acting like my dad, you know, that kind of thing, because you can't help it. Whoever the biggest influence is, that's the traits of behaviours that you'll follow. The other part is news speak, which was defined by, I think it was George Orwell in 1984, because we were talking about how language is a very important part of thinking. Now, what he highlighted is that the news speak would essentially strip all of those really important, all of those complex, all of those very specific words out of the language and more or less just have a couple. I think he said there was a maximum of 200 words or something of that nature that would be allowed on a broadcast. This is what he learned when he was working as a propagandist for the BBC during World War One, and it seems that he claimed that if people did not have the language to describe the issue that they're dealing with, they wouldn't be able to deal with the issue at all. Now, other elements that we talk about are usually just environmental elements that can affect intelligence, things like aluminium, fluoride, EMF and EMR frequencies that make people kind of a bit having headaches and not being able to think clearly and things of that nature. Studies have come out that all of these things are affecting us, but, you know, as you say, there's only 20% really difference between that 80% genetic intelligence level.
Can I perhaps deal with these very interesting questions that you ask, and then we can go on to some other ones? Would that be all right?
Sure, I've just got a couple.
Otherwise, I'll forget them.
Go ahead.
I'll be writing that. So first of all, with regard to environmental pollutants affecting our intelligence. It's certainly true that they do, to some degree, perhaps do that, and it also seemed to have some association with autism. But my colleague did a study where he kind of computed different models of what was the cause of our intelligence decline based on the known evidence of the amount of these different chemicals or whatever in the environment over certain years, and then he did another model. Based on the idea that it wasn't to do with that, it was to do with genes and so on. And it was the model that was to do with genes that fitted the data, that fitted the data that we have. And it was the model that was to do with pollutants that didn't fit the data at all. Now, that's not to say that there isn't an element of truth in it, but it's to say in terms of science, in terms of statistical significance and the sample size and whatever, and it's quite big, it didn't fit it at all. Also, if you think that our intelligence was going up across the medieval period, across the Tudor period, across the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, there was an extraordinary amount of pollution in the Industrial Revolution, even before it, that we were exposed to. I mean, pregnant women would use makeup with mercury in it. People drank alcohol only, pretty much only alcohol, because the water was so dirty. And so consequently, pregnant women would be drinking alcohol, only alcohol. And so there were all these pollutants to which we were exposed. But even so, we were becoming more intelligent. So that is consistent with the genetic model. You ask about Bruce Lipton. I must confess that I'm not familiar with that name. But if you look at something like social status, what is socioeconomic status? There's a degree to which it is intelligence plus personality plus luck. And that's what Arthur Jensen, who was a great researcher of intelligence, argued. Intelligence plus personality plus luck. Intelligence is about 80% genetic. Personality, it's harder to measure, but it's somewhere between 50 and 60% genetic, the kind of personality you have, whether you're extrovert or introvert. And different personality traits predict different outcomes in life. So people who are very conscientious, very high in extroversion, very low in mental instability, high in openness and being open to new ideas, these kinds of people, they tend to do well in life. And people that they tend to get high socioeconomic status, even if they're not that intelligent. You know, we're talking about the kind of person that would become the head girl at a school, you know, that kind of person. And then the opposite people, they end up in prison or they end up, you know, the extreme opposite, low conscientiousness, alcoholism, drug addiction, low impulse control. That's what conscientiousness is, impulse control. So these are the essence of socioeconomic status. And it's quite, there was a study by Greg Clark, who I mentioned earlier. He's a very interesting guy. We should try and get him on here. But and he did a study called The Sun Also Rises. And he showed that between the medieval period and the modern day, based on studies of surnames and their status across time, you know, the percentage of people with this surname that are barristers or who are doctors or who are poor, right? He showed that across time, across generations, the heritability of status was always about the same. It's about 70%. Now, what that implies is that status, as it were, behavior, is very strongly genetic, but not completely so. And if you look at adoption studies, the intelligence and behavior of adopted children does not resemble in any way that's statistically significant, certainly not with intelligence. The intelligence of their adoptive parents.
If anything, it's not so much to do with intelligence as it is to do with health. I think Bruce Lipton actually cited one case where he had a family that had two children, and that family had a history of cancer, but they adopted one of those children out into a family that had, again, a history of cancer, and another family that didn't have a history of cancer. Now,
that would be the luck, though, wouldn't it?
Pardon?
Well, first of all, that would be the luck. I said it was intelligence plus behavior plus luck.
What he was saying was that, in fact, it was the environment, because they found that the child who had a history of cancer in his own family, when he was adopted into a family that didn't have any history of cancer, he didn't develop it. And the other child who had a history of cancer, who went into a family that did have a history of cancer as well, he wound up getting cancer.
But do we know factors were behind getting cancer? Because a lot of the, if children that are adopted are often from quite low status backgrounds, and being from a low status background is often correlated with low impulse control and low agreeableness, and these behaviors are often correlated with with unhealthy lifestyle choices, with being overweight, with being an alcoholic, with taking drugs, with eating
that's what
wrong
I'm saying
food.
You've hit the nail on the head there, is because that environment that affects our body and stuff like that isn't necessarily a reflection of our intelligence. If anything, it's the opposite way around. Our intelligence becomes the reflection of our environment because we create our environment.
I think there's a degree to which it's, I agree with you, make a good point. I think it's a degree, it's symbiotic, really. So if you have low intelligence, there's evidence, there's a study in, it was on British data, something called Von Strom or something. And he showed that when you, if we look at just intelligence, when you take people who are working class English and people who are middle class English, then at the age of about 5, there's an IQ difference of something like 6 or 7 points. Now, the younger something is the case, the more it's genetic. So this implies that that is essentially a genetic thing. Now, by the time these people are in their teens, the IQ difference is like 20 points, 25 points. It's huge. Because there's this snowball effect of intelligence. If you are intelligent, then your parents will create a more intellectually stimulating environment for you. And then when you break free of that environment and you will create your own environment, you will create an environment which will reflect your own intelligence. And this will then further push to its phenotypic limit your intelligence. Whereas the working class child will do the opposite. And in fact, there's quite good evidence from adoption studies this, that the heritability, when we say the heritability of intelligence is 80%, we mean among adults, not among children. Because among children, it's the parents that are creating the environment and it reflects their intelligence. And it does happen that by genetic chance, of course it does, that's why you get socioeconomic movement throughout history, that you get somebody very intelligent just by chance, that I know Thomas Cromwell or someone like this, who's born into quite a modest background and then is very clever and for whatever reason and you know, moves up the society. So that person will then, when breaking free, they won't do that well at school even, or Cromwell did, but often because their intelligence will be held back by the environment that their parents are creating. And then once they get a bit older, and you often find this, I think, with very clever people that are from working class backgrounds, they don't shine until a bit later, because maybe they don't get into a very good university, but then they do really well at university and they go and do a PhD somewhere really good. They're held back by their parents and by their parents, the low intelligent environment. People who have low intelligence even talk to their children less. They literally stimulate them less, right? And so, of course, the thing is that the opposite can happen. So you can get a child whose parents are very clever, they're both doctors or something, and for whatever reason, he's not that bright, and his environment that they're creating, which reflects the parents' intelligence, will mean that he does very well at school, and he gets into, I don't know, Oxford or something, and then at Oxford, where he's creating his own environment, he'll do really badly and fail his degree. You can see that this, but it's clear that there's a strong genetic element to these differences, both in terms of intelligence and also in terms of personality. Again, if you're elderly, what do you do when you're old? A lot of academics, their job is their life. They love it. And so they retire and they just carry on doing what they used to be paid to do for free. But they only do the research element. They don't do the teaching element. Whereas a lot of, you get maybe someone who's a doctor or a lawyer, and there's a strong degree to which he does the job for money. He retires, spends his time playing golf, his IQ will go down. And Jim Flynn, your New Zealand-based University of Otago, that's where he's based.
Otago,
I do beg your pardon. Although, to be fair, when we had this teacher, Miss Douglas, an English teacher, and we were doing Twelfth Night, and she said to us, I've been to Stratford-upon-Avon, I've seen Shakespeare's beard. And we were like, you've seen his beard? I didn't that was preserved. Yeah, I've seen Shakespeare's beard. It's very small, and she meant bed.
Yeah,
but she's beard. It was most peculiar. She also used to say "hoi hoi," which may be a phrase which is "hoi" like that, a New Zealand thing. I don't know, but forget it. Anyway, forgive my mispronunciation of Otago, but Otago. Yes. So you can see that there is this relationship between the two, and it means that highly intelligent people will create highly intelligent environments for themselves, and they will associate with other highly intelligent people as well. And this is another important factor. A colleague of mine called Haina Rinderman has looked at this. So the smart faction. If you're brought up in some village in, northern Lapland, Inari or something, there won't be many stimulating people around to talk to. And in terms of friends, you'll have to make do with the people that are there. And well, maybe there's a lawyer in Inari and a doctor and whatever. But a lot of people, they hunt reindeer. That's what they do. And so it will impact the extent to which the phenotypic maximum of your intelligence is reached. But if you live in a city or go to a university, particularly a good one, then you're much likely to run into very clever people and spend all your time with them. And so it will push to its limit your intelligence. And so then as you were saying, you have this environmental factor. Yes, intelligence is going down, and it's going down for genetic reasons, but once it starts doing that, then there are fewer intelligent people for, let's say, a very intelligent person that happens to come along to talk to, which reduces his intelligence. So you end up with this appalling environmental avalanche of stupidity, and this is how societies fall.
Yeah
or partly.
Well, I think anybody who's lived in a small town and then moved to a big city because you were bored as hell there knows exactly what you're talking about. I include myself in that. The concepts, another things that I want to actually put into this is because we talk about environmental factors have a very minimal effect in terms of toxins and stuff like that on intelligence. Now, recently we've had the social media phenomenon, and according to Dr. Sam Vaknin, he's saying that this is creating an epidemic of narcissism, selfish narcissism, more or less. And I was wondering what effect that has of intelligence if you only care about yourself and don't really listen to anybody.
Well, you've got to ask yourself what's causing. So, what does narcissism manifest as? And narcissism manifests as an inflated sense of self. It manifests as basically very high self-esteem, really. There was a very interesting guy from New Zealand called Derek Freeman. Have you heard of him? I understood he was quite famous in New Zealand.
Unfortunately not.
He was an anthropologist, and he did this critique of Margaret Mead, who was another anthropologist, the research in Samoa. And he was amazing. He was extraordinary. He was an archetypal narcissist. He was brought up by his mother to believe he was a kind of messiah. And he extraordinary guy. Anyway, Derek Freeman, fascinating guy. But anyway, the part of it's intelligence, because intelligence correlates with low self-esteem. It correlates with high levels of trust, and narcissists tend to be distrusting. People who are intelligent can empathize better. They're higher in empathy because they can imagine what it's like to be another person. They're more socially skilled because, again, they can imagine what it's like to be another person. They care more about people because, again, they can imagine what it's like to be another person, which is why if you track through time this literacy going up and numeracy going up, it's paralleled by cruelty to animals and cruelty to people going down because we're becoming more intelligent. And so there's a degree to which I would wonder if the epidemic of narcissism is partly a genetic thing, that we're just getting more stupid. But there are probably other factors as well to it, I'm sure, absolutely. Think about many years ago, most people didn't even know what they looked like. They'd know what they looked like from maybe blurred vision in a lake. I mean, they didn't really know what they looked like. And then you have the invention of mirrors. And people talk about at the time of people standing, looking at themselves in mirrors and gazing into the mirrors and all this kind of thing. And then you end up with this situation now where we can take photographs. I mean, when I was a kid, my parents might take, I don't know, 50 photographs a year, maybe. I don't know, less than that, on holiday only, once a year. 30 photographs a year. And now people are taking photographs all the time of themselves, uploading them, these selfies. And then people comment on them and all this, these nasty anonymous trolls, you know. I'm sure someone will say, oh, well, I don't like his jumper or whatever. And so these things, I think, elevate these kinds of traits. Low intelligence is going to elevate narcissism. And it could be argued that we're not used to this ability to be able to see ourselves like this or whatever. That's potentially going to elevate narcissism. I wouldn't be surprised. And also, it could be argued that the environment is a problem. So people in the old days were not taught at people now are taught at schools about their rights and about what people can't do to them, and it's all about child centric. You can't smack kids at school anymore. In Finland, you can't even shout at kids anymore. There are no boundaries. There is no boundaries at all to help to develop a properly functioning sense of self. There was research by Herrnstein and Wilson, I think it was, in 1985, and they found that the most adapted children are those whose parents are loving yet harsh. So parents who are loving to their children, but literally, I mean, engage in corporal punishment. This is research from the 70s. Loving yet harsh. And then if they were loving, and if they were harsh yet unloving, that was terrible. That did very bad things. But equally, if they were loving and unharsh, it created these narcissistic traits.
Yeah, that's what it does. They had a study of two children, and they said, okay, you tried really hard. And the other one is, you're really brilliant. And these two groups of children, one of them developed narcissism and one of them didn't, because one of them wanted to work really hard for stuff because they were praised for trying, and the other one didn't want to work hard for stuff because they were praised for being special. And that's essentially, in a nutshell, what causes narcissism.
They don't have setbacks anymore. Mm. So, I mean, when I was at school in the 38, and when I was at school in England in the 80s, not only for the first few years of us being at school could they smack us legally, but also, you know, you had sports and things, and people were bad at it, people were good at it. There was no everyone's a winner. I was very bad at sport, and so PE would be a humiliation every day, or every time we did it. And that was the way it was. And for other people, maths would be a humiliation or whatever. But that was the system, and it creates this... Is he based in Australia? There's a guy called Jim Penman. He talks about this concept of vigour. And so certain societies instill certain ethnocentric values, really. Values of positively ethnocentric values. Values of self-sacrifice. Values of putting others before yourself. Values of suppressing emotion. The kind of values which were supposed to be heightened in the English public school system. The militaristic values, essentially. Mm. Values of an army. And there's a degree to which school, which used to be modelled, certainly public school, on an army, is now less and less modelled on this. And the whole point of these kinds of institutions was, like Sparta or whatever, was to basically extinguish the self, was to make you not have a self, to make that self inextricably linked up with the good of the rest of society.
Collectivism.
And it's narcissists that aren't like that. Narcissists are out for themselves.
Well, it seems that there's a possibility that the rise in narcissism is kind of like a, I don't know, what did Sam Vakman say? He says narcissism is like a virus, and what a virus does is it'll grow to a certain point and it'll do a lot of damage, but then eventually it'll come back down again. So he thinks that what's happening in our society now is we've had a huge rise of narcissism like a virus, but just like the plague only killed about a third of the population or whatever, he thinks that it's eventually going to level out, society's going to get destroyed by it and then rebuild itself.
Well, I would agree with that.
Now, the concept that came up was C.S. Lewis's talk on chivalry. Now, when you're raising a child or something like that, he said that Lancelot was called the greatest knight. And when he said this, the legend goes that he cried, he wept as though a child being beaten. And it was interesting because they said that the concept of chivalry was that he was a brutal warrior to the nth degree, and he was also the meekest gentleman that ever sat in a hall with ladies to the nth degree.
This is the essence of what the public school system tried to produce. I've got a book coming out later this year. It's published in Australia, actually, because for some reason I couldn't find a British publisher prepared to touch it, called Churchill's Headmaster, The Sadist Who Nearly Saved the British Empire. And that book argued, people say that this Herbert Snape Kinnersley, who was Churchill's prep school headmaster, was this sadistic bastard, this horrible person, this sodomite, all these terrible things that he supposedly was. And I demonstrate that all that's rubbish. It's not true. It's simply inaccurate. It's a consequence of propaganda by Winston Churchill and somebody called Roger Fry. And I traced other pupils, their descendants rather, whose great-grandparents or grandparents had kept diaries at the time, contemporary sources, and written autobiographies late in life. And a completely different person comes across. And he comes across as basically a person who is an excellent teacher, an inspirer of people, who does beat children, but that's what they all did, but doesn't beat them. Maybe he beats them a bit overly severely, but certainly not in an unfair way and certainly not in an inconsistent way, which when children have a particularly strong sense of fairness, and when fairness is administered wrongly, unfairly, with the cane, that's much worse, I think, than it being administered correctly, but over the top, at least for a child. And so actually, what he was doing was he was trying to mould these people into Lancelots. That was his stated point, to make them extremely chivalrous and whatever, but also able to defend the empire against all that would try to destroy it, which is really what, to a certain degree, although in a much nastier way, what the Spartans wanted to do. And there's an extent to which the public school system was modelled on the Spartans, that you take children away at a young age from their parents and you know, these sort of rites of passage you have in tribes. And there's an element to which then our schooling system was modelled on these kinds of... And I suggest Churchill was withdrawn from that school. Churchill was very narcissistic, there's no question about that, and I present a great deal of evidence for that. In the book, he was extremely narcissistic. He was an archetypal narcissist. And I present a great deal of evidence for that. I say, well, if he hadn't been withdrawn from that school after 2 years, it's perfectly possible that he would have not become a narcissist, and that would have had certain positive consequences, perhaps even with the empire. That's the argument. But you know, it's that system, and all the schooling system we have was kind of modelled on that system to some degree, that has collapsed and has made people, has let's say, reduced from its phenotypic maximum our selflessness. So there's perhaps an environmental element to it. But there's also, I think, a genetic element to it, because it is the low intelligence who are breeding. We've lost 15 points since the Victorian era, since 1880, since the height of this system of chivalry or whatever, you know. And we an intelligence predicts basically aspects of narcissism, really. It predicts this kind of stuff. So I think that it's fairly central to it.
Yeah, and in fact, it's interesting that you mentioned the Spartans before, because just yesterday I was thinking about the intelligence of society, the immorality of society, the inability of the larger population to understand natural law principles, what is naturally right, what is naturally wrong, that kind of thing. And I was thinking about the Spartans and how they created an incredibly strong warrior race. But the thing is, that was done with brutality, with rape, with abuse, with verbal abuse. In fact, there was a competition that they had to have in order to see who had the quickest wit, and they would insult each other and reply and so on and so forth. And the thought came to me that the harsher a child is treated, the stronger that child becomes. And then at a time when those children were grown into men, that kind of thing, when their empire was attacked by what was at the time considered to be a much, much larger force, they were capable and they had the grit to stand their ground and prevent them from taking over their country, essentially.
Intelligence isn't the only thing which predicts winning in wars. The main thing is ethnocentrism. Sorry, forgive me twitching. It's very icy here, and I fell over the other day on my back and bloody hurt myself. I'm in tremendous pain! It's very, very dangerous here when it gets to, like, -1. The ice, you're in trouble. My wife broke a leg 1 year in the garden. I mean, it's really bad. So, but forget my pain, but I'm sorry if I keep moving about. But there was an interesting aspect to this, I think, this idea that there was another book I've got coming out, actually, quite soon, called Race Differences in Ethnocentrism. And we look at the studies on this, and we show that, or I show, that if you look at computer models and you use Prisoner's Dilemma, which is this thing in economics where you have to cooperate with people, if you cooperate, you lose a bit. If they cooperate, they lose a bit, like that. And in the end, it's those who can cooperate who end up doing well. And this system was extrapolated onto a computer grid by various jolly clever computer types. And they showed that if you come up with four kinds of person on this grid, and you give them a life expectancy, and you let them breed like a busy lizard, you know, they can breed asexually. That is those who never cooperate with anybody, those who cooperate but only with the opposite colour, i.e. traitors, those who cooperate but only with their own colour, ethnocentrics, and those who cooperate with everybody, i.e. multiculturalists or whatever, then it is the ethnocentrics that eventually always dominate the grid. Ethnocentrism is selected for. Mm. Ethnocentrism, that's why we're high in it. It's probably partly genetic. And there's quite good, there's actually candidate genes that relate to it. Ethnocentrism, and so you could have a situation where you could think of two strategies that you would use to dominate. And one would be, let's call it the intelligence strategy. This is our strategy. And you have a relatively large gene pool, and this throws up outliers because you have a large gene pool. And this is what geniuses are. They're outliers, the inventors. They tend to combine very high IQ, outlier high IQ, with moderately disagreeable, moderately antisocial personality. And this means that when they come up with an vision like, A, they can think outside the box, they have low conscientiousness, and B, they can, normally an innovation, something new offends vested interests, but they don't care about that. They're kind of autistic in that way. They don't care about people's feelings. And indeed, they wouldn't be able to anticipate them even if they did care about them. So you get people like James Watson, you know, the DNA guy, the pioneer, and he got in trouble recently for what he said about race differences. He was empirically accurate about what he said, but he can't help himself. He's a bit kind of Asperger's, really.
What did he say?
He said that there are race differences in intelligence, and that's the reason why Africa's not doing very well.
Well, they did the fucking IQ studies to prove it, so what are people arguing about?
Indeed, but you're not allowed to say that if you're in a position of power like him. You have to be publicly damaged and defenestrated.
People can't handle the truth that is written by facts because it... What was it? It messes with my beliefs, therefore I'm not going to accept it.
Yes, this is the case. And I often get this with the comments that I get on my YouTube page. You get these people who don't like what I've said because it challenges somebody they like or something. And so they go, oh, you're an idiot. So this is what I mean. And so you have that strategy. And that strategy with the genius means that the genius can come up with an invention, and then the society can invade other societies, and they can trade, and they can expand, and their gene pool can get bigger, and they can come up with more inventions, and more inventions, and more inventions, and whatever, right? And they can dominate other societies, like the West did, as long as the ethnocentrism level doesn't drop too low. As long as they've got an optimum level of ethnocentrism in comparison to their level of genius and intelligence, they're fine. And sometimes religion is a part of that, because religiousness has been shown to be demonstrably associated with ethnocentrism, and sometimes other factors are part of that, like evolutionary factors or whatever. Or nationalism, independent of religion or whatever. But it can't drop below a certain level. The alternative strategy is perhaps what you have in Japan, or even Finland to a lesser extent, which is a very small gene pool indeed, because it's strongly adapted to the environment. because the environment is so harsh and so stable. And that means that if you deviate from the adaptation, high adaptation to it in any way, you won't survive. So you end up with a very small gene pool. You end up with a very small difference between the cleverest person and the stupidest person. A very small difference between, let's say, the most conscientious person and the least conscientious person. And thus very few geniuses. High intelligence, perhaps. Perhaps even higher intelligence than Western countries. And the Japanese have an IQ of about 5 points higher than us. As far as I can work out, the Finns have an IQ that's about 2 points higher than us. Well, the New Zealanders, the New Zealanders and Australians seem to have an IQ of about 102, but that's because they're a select population. Cleverer people migrate, and the cleverer English migrated to New Zealand or Australia, and so, of course, the IQ is high. Basically, that's what's going on. And so that's the way they survive. And if their ethnocentrism is so strong, like the Spartans, then they can win against a technologically more advanced society, at least in the short term.
If I may.
And you get that sometimes.
If I may, the Spartans actually did have more advanced technology at the time when they were invaded by Persia. Their shields were made of brass and bronze, which was a lot stronger. And in fact, they were up against arrows that were made of, I think it was palm wood. So they would just bounce right off them. They wouldn't even penetrate. So that's part of the reason. And in fact, I like to bring up the concept of war technology and strategy. These two things are in fact, some of the greatest factors in who wins a battle and who loses. Who's got the best strategy? Who's got the best technology? Now, what is the factor within a society that determines who's making all these great new inventions?
Best
war?
Technology would be expected, to be genius.
Yeah, and then of course, genius war, strategy on top of that.
Genius strategy would then set off invasions, war, technology, further development of technology, further expansion, larger gene pool, more genius, and so on. So you can see, but very occasionally, the grit, the medieval philosopher Ibn Khaldun called asabiyyah of the less developed forces, can be so the ethnocentrism really can be so strong, and when the ethnocentrism of the highly intelligent group has become weak, when they've lost, let's say, their religiousness, they've lost their belief that they're the only chosen people, they've lost their belief that they're special ethnically or whatever. They've lost these things. They're very low in stress, and so they become decadent and laid back and uninstinctive, and they stop breeding, and they you know, which is what was seemingly happening towards the end of Greece. If you compare Greece to Rome, I think you know more about this area than me. Manifestly, I didn't do classics very much, but as I understand it, and equally towards the end of Rome when they were invaded by the outsiders of the enemy at the gate. Yeah, and so then these people come in. And they are able, and I think this is what's happening with Islam today, to, with their higher asabiyyah, even though IQ may be lower, their higher asabiyyah, their higher sense of ethnocentrism and self-sacrifice and purpose and all this, to basically take over. And the people who are highly intelligent, once they're the factors that cause them to be ethnocentric, i.e. religiousness or instinctive nationalism, once those things are gone, and if we have very low stress... One of the things that predicts religiousness is stress. I don't mean that religious people are more stressed. I mean, if you get stressed, you will tend to stop believing in God and become religious and stop praying.
That actually happened to me one time just after I got busted for cannabis when I was 19. My legs gave out on me when I was trying to walk up some stairs because I was so stressed, and I started calling out to God to just give me the strength just to walk up the stairs to be able to get home, that kind of thing, and I was given that strength. Now, did I become religious
after that? No.
As soon as the stress left my life...
If you're in pre-modern conditions, or even conditions until 100 years ago or something, think of the level of mortality salience. People just drop dead. And nobody understands why. People just suddenly get ill and it's incurable. A lot of people would have lost siblings when they were young from measles or whatever, childhood diseases. Your dad will make, not a lot of Victorian people, by the time they were adults, at least one of their parents was dead. So people have suffered the loss of siblings. They've suffered the loss of parents. They've suffered the loss of grandparents at formative ages, they suffer the loss of friends, So their mortality salience is high. So their stress level is high. And so, because they could drop dead. And so you can see then why religiousness becomes attractive in those circumstances. And if the level of stress drops too low, and it seems that this is what the industrial society creates, and it could be argued that this is what was created in ancient Greece as well, at least among the upper class, then people stop being religious. And once they stop being religious, they start questioning the religion and they question the things that it holds up, like ethnocentrism and this kind of behavior. And there's a degree to which, you know, children are no longer God's will. They're a bloody inconvenience, and I could get a much better standard of living by not having many. And so this, combined with contraception as well, can start to reduce intelligence because the upper class are overwhelmingly not religious. And then it starts messing with public policy, because the upper class are coming out with policies which the working class are against, because the working class are, as it were, more stressed and so more, well, I suppose, normal in terms of our history. If you look at Brexit in the UK, the upper class are overwhelmed, and therefore the Parliament, are overwhelmingly in favour of staying in the EU. And it was these working class areas, a lot of people had never voted before or hadn't voted since the 80s, come out and vote with this nationalism, this latent nationalism, which the people at the top of society don't really believe in. And so you've got this fundamental, with, you know, this divide in the UK.
And I was thinking, as you were saying before, about how when you've had siblings die, or when you've got bad circumstances, or people die for no reason at all, of that kind of thing, that's when they become religious. And I thought to myself, I think it was F. Murray Abraham, and it was in a movie that I just watched, and he says, that's why the church created hell, all right, is to frighten people into accepting our things. And that's why the church created heaven, so that when anything bad happens to a sibling or a grandparent or somebody that dies or somebody who's got some bad thing, oh, they're going to a nice place. Whereas if something bad happens to you because of a normal person in your life or whatever, oh, that person's going to hell. And so, ergo, you have a stress relief valve, more or less, for the entirety of society. But as soon as people's religious belief overall just sort of wanes, that's usually the destruction of that society very quickly, soon after. And indeed, the I think it was former KGB agent who was interviewed in the 1970s, he said that part of the communists' ideal was to destroy religions, because that would destroy people's societies more or less, and make them a hell of a lot easier to influence, invade, or trick in any way, shape, or form.
I think that's very, very true, and I think you make a very good point about heaven and hell. And there was a researcher. What was his name? Now it's something like Noren Zion. Sorry, forgive the agony. Jesus Christ! Poor there we Christ. Go. I prayed. That much stress. Don't fall on the ice in this country. Seriously, it's very bad. But anyway, there was something called Noren Zion, and he argues that where does religion come from? Well, one thing is that it reduces stress. If you believe in God, then you have this constant best friend. He's looking after you, and everything will be okay in the end, and this reduces stress. That's an environmental issue. Another is altruism. So there's quite good evidence that if people feel they're being watched, then they'll behave in a more pro-social way. Well, you've got someone pro-social, you've got this pro-social watcher there all the time. And so if you have that person there, you're less likely to be cast out of a band, and you're more likely to pass on your genes. And so for those reasons, I mean, there are other reasons as well, but for those reasons, it may be that that's one of the reasons why religiousness became selected for. And once that happens, then religiousness becomes an insurance policy. Because by accepting the dogmas of the group, which are normally inherently illogical, it's not just that you believe in God. I mean, maybe there's a God, maybe there's not. But that you accept, you know, Jesus rode on the day, first day, third day, and ascended into heaven and descended into hell and all this stuff, right? That you can't prove. And so once you, if you accept that, you're saying, I'm prepared to sacrifice my intellectual faculties. I'm prepared basically to not think in order to show my conformity to the group. And so that's showing that you're a highly conformist person. You're high in conscientiousness. You're high in impulse control. And this is attractive as a friend. It's attractive as a partner, because that person's not going to love you and leave you. He's not going to leave you holding the baby. So it becomes sexually selected for. Equally with women, it becomes sexually selected for, because women, that woman is not going to cuckold you. You know, she's going to be honest, basically. And there's quite good evidence on this, that religiousness is correlated. There's always people that turn around and say, no, it isn't. But, you know, email me and I can show you the studies. Even in non-religious societies, religiousness is correlated with agreeableness, i.e. altruism. People who are religious are more altruistic, partly perhaps because it makes them more altruistic, and partly because I suspect that this, it is adaptive. The people who would have passed on their genes in pre-modern times would have been those who were highly intelligent, but also those that were high in those personality traits I mentioned earlier. And those personality traits, agreeableness, conscientiousness, low mental instability, not so much low mental instability, but agreeableness and conscientiousness, those personality traits predict religiousness. And so partly this is an environmental thing, but partly it's also a genetic thing. Religiousness is 40% genetic. And being like fundamentalist religious, being really, 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 or having a religious experience, a really profound kind of St. Paul, Damascus religious experience, is about 66% genetic. And it's correlated with fertility. People that are religious have more children. And there are various other correlates which demonstrate that this is obviously something that's been selected for. We're selected to be religious. And I suspect that partly we're less religious now because of, the stress and so on, so environmental factor. And this is definitely true, because we know that in World War I and World War II, before then, church attendance was declining. World War I goes up, decline. World War II and the 50s stays up, that kind of trauma. And then in the 60s, it goes down, dramatically down. And so this is consistent with the environmental aspect to religiousness. But there's also a genetic aspect, in so much as religiousness is correlated with health, and it seems to be correlated with health at the genetic level. People who are religious are simply genetically more healthy. I've got a paper on this called The Mutant Says in His Heart There Is No God. And what we show, we get these various markers for being high in mutation. One is autism. One is left-handedness, because we're supposed to be right-handed. So if you're left-handed, then often something's gone wrong with the development of the brain. I'm left-handed, by the way, so but I'm afraid that's the way it is. Another one was how symmetrical your face is, so basically how good-looking you are. If you have an asymmetrical face, it means you have mutant genes in the face, or your immune system is bad, and mental illness, various other things. And we show that being religious, being an atheist, is correlated with these markers of mutation. And so it implies that we've been selected for this norm of being highly intelligent, of being, you know, this certain kind of personality, and of being religious. And then with evolution, that's it. With the Industrial Revolution, this selection level collapses. And the result of that is all these people, I mean, child mortality goes from 40% to now about 1%. And so population of England in about 1650 was about 6 or 7 million, and now it's 65 million. And it's probable that there'd be about 10% of that would survive under conditions of Darwinian selection. Everybody else would be, as it were, mutants. And my colleague Michael Woodley, who I wrote At Our Wit's End with, he has this theory. He calls it the social epistasis amplification model. And the idea is that 84% of our genome is the brain. And this means that if you have, and this is a fact, that physical mutations, physical problems, you know, physical conditions, whatever, tend to correlate with mental problems. They're comorbid, right? And this makes sense, because of course 84% of the genome is the brain, so there's this massive target of mutation, and of course it'll be hit. And so he suggests that what will therefore happen is you'll get people who in the old days would have been selected out because they had poor immune systems. And those people will have maladaptive ideas, such as perhaps atheism, such as not being nationalistic, such as not wanting to have children, such as, you know, saying it's bad to have children. What was it someone said recently? Someone said it's immoral to have children.
It's a crime against the environment.
Who was it? It was somebody. I can't remember. Was it that silly young politician in America? Or so? I can't remember.
Cortez?
Anyway. Yeah, something silly. These mutants will start to undermine the delicate superorganism. People are evolved to be with other people who are genetically relatively normal, and then everything kind of ticks along. And once someone runs into your life who's not like that, they will cause your genes, even if you're not a carrier of the mutations, to be what my colleague calls spiteful mutations, to be expressed. suboptimally. And it's a bit like my colleague argued, if you imagine a beehive, it's everything's fine, it all ticks along, you've got just the right amount of workers, just the right amount of queens and drones and feeders and whatever castes. And then you get one mutant feeder. And that mutant feeder feeds a little bit much to this bee, a little bit too little to this bee, and it creates a suboptimal balance, too many queens, not enough workers, whatever. That's going to damage the entire social organism. And that's true with us. And so then these people will start spreading their maladaptive ideas. And often, in so much as the heritability of status is about 70%, it's likely that the upper class, who are descended from the upper class, will have been under Darwinian selection for less time than people lower down the hierarchy, than working class people. And that would make sense of why these maladaptive ideas, such as anti-nationalism and anti-religion, come from there, and why it's the working class who are A, under stress, and B, basically less mutated, who are because the influence of mutational intelligence is relatively limited. It takes a long time to hit in, you see, with intelligence. Mm-hmm. So this is the theory of my colleague, anyway. And so this would start to make sense of what's of this divide that's increasingly the case between the top, the haves and the have-nots. And it would mean, I mean, if you think about it, what the internet can do, you could have somebody who's perfectly normal, and then the internet allows them to come into contact with somebody that encourages people to be anorexic or encourages people to kill themselves. And you never come in contact with somebody like that normally. But with the internet, or encourages them to be narcissistic, let's say, or encourages them to be non-binary. This is an epidemic at the moment in a lot of British schools. You get among girls, among the same kind of girls that used to be anorexic, the correlates are the same. They have manly fingers, so they have high testosterone, and there are various other marks of testosterone that both female to male transsexuals and anorexics have. So it's probably the same thing, that they have a weak sense of self because they are kind of a bit autistic. Mm. This spreads like a contagion. You get five or six girls coming out at once saying, oh, I'm, you know, non-binary. Now, of course, what the teacher at the girls' school should say to those people is, okay, you're not a girl anymore, then so get out of the school. Go to the boys' school. And I'm sure the boys' school, with its compulsory communal showers, will be very happy to have you. But of course, they don't say that, and they alter the uniform, and they do God knows what, you know. And so you can see how the internet spreads these contagions. And I remember you got in touch with me because of the interview on Red Ice. And I remarked to Henrik about this, that there's a counterbalance to this problem, which is shows like this that try to keep people aware of the truth. But does that compensate for the insanity that the internet has the potential to unleash in terms of these mutants spreading their maladaptive views?
One thing that was happening to me a lot lately is people arguing with me that I've got white privilege and male privilege. Now, based upon what you've said about 80% of genetics being correlatory with intelligence, being a white guy automatically gives me some kind of privilege, right? Even though I didn't work for it. But the other concept is here, are these people kind of going on about this sort of thing? Is that just a maladaptive idea? Like, oh, there's male privilege, there's white privilege, as opposed to, hello, yeah, learn as much as you can, bust your ass.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt. It's an utterly maladaptive idea. It's a self-flagellating idea. Now, there's a degree to which an element, we are basically, if you are a people who are high in intelligence, intelligence is correlated with altruism, intelligence is correlated with low self-esteem, and intelligence is correlated with trust. And if you have no ethnocentrism, because you have no religion or you have no nationalism or whatever, to counterweight that, then your high intelligence can be weaponized against you. And that's what these mutant multiculturalists and whatever, feminists and whatever, that's what they do. They're weaponizing against us our high trust, that we trust them and we think, oh, it'll all be okay, and we want to be nice to them, and they weaponize against us basically our low self-esteem. This idea that, oh, you have male privilege. I mean, what's the difference between that really and the Calvinist conception that we're just debased and shit and awful before God? Mm. It's the same kind of idea. It's the idea that we're just ghastly, we're just appalling. Except the difference is that Calvinism notes that anybody who is not a Christian, anybody that's not in our group, and that is evil. And of course, that's not, you know, if you're within our group and you don't debase yourself, you're evil. But if you're outside our group, you're basically inherently evil. And so this issue is not there. I mean, this idea of white privilege as well, it's just statistical nonsense. If you read the work, there was an interesting researcher at the University of Kent called Joanna Williams, and she published a book on multiculturalism and postmodernism in the universities. And they could deal with that. That was published by a major publisher, Paul Graves Macmillan. She published another book called Women versus Feminism, which basically demonstrated that it's not that you know, women are less equal than men. Yes, it is the other way around. There are actually tremendous advantages to being a woman.
Yeah.
And unsurprisingly, of course, she couldn't get that out with a major publisher. She had to publish that somewhere obscure. Now, I don't know if she sent it to Paul Graves Macmillan and they rejected it. But Paul Graves Macmillan certainly rejected it at our wit's end. On the basis of basically leftist reviews, so I wouldn't be at all surprised. It's statistical nonsense, this idea of male privilege. If anything, it's quite the opposite. A lot of males now are absolutely fucked, because under conditions of sort of Darwinian selection or whatever, under these pre-modern conditions, and under conditions where you say that it's wrong to have sex outside marriage, under religious conditions, basically women can't be polygamous. They can't be polygynous. Men can't be polygamous. Men can't have numerous women. It's sanctioned against, and it's good that it's sanctioned against, because what it means is that the society is more cooperative. In polygamous societies, they're very, very violent societies, because women sexually select for status, because if you did that in prehistory, then, you know, your baby and you will be more likely to survive. So women sexually select for status. Men, if they want to, they have nothing to lose from the sexual encounter, so they can bonk as many women as they want to. I mean, there's no limit, as long as they can get away with it. There's no limit to what they can do. And so obviously they don't sexually select for status. They want lots and lots of sex with lots and lots of women, and to the extent that they have to select, it's best to select for youth and beauty. These are signs of fertility. Youth, you can get pregnant. Beauty, symmetry, good genes, you know, low mutation, more likely to get pregnant, kids are more likely to survive. And so now we're in a situation where all these safeguards break down and people can do what they like. And of course, what's happening now is that once women, feminists, become highly educated, they want to marry, as it were, hypergamously. They want to marry up. But now that we're in a situation where women are actually more educated than men, because what predicts being educated is intelligence, yes, but also these personality factors such as agreeableness and conscientiousness, women are higher in these. And as a consequence, women do better in education, and they're more educated than men, albeit in low IQ PhD subjects like English literature or whatever, rather than in science. But they're more educated than men. And so they want to marry somebody who's even more educated than them. But there's so few of those people that there's no one. And so therefore what happens is that they end up not having children, and they end up gaining, you know, they're so repelled by the idea of marrying down, you know, by marrying the bit of rough, as it were, you know, that they'd rather just not have children and gain some satisfaction out of having affairs with high-status males. And so, therefore, increasingly, we're reverting to a situation, this incel idea, where a lot of men will find, low-status men or men who are physically unattractive or whatever, those men would have got wives and they would have got girlfriends in the old days. But now that we're reverting to a de facto polygamous society, really, where they're nothing. And what that creates is as we see with the Bushmen, it creates conflict. And it creates low ethnocentrism because nobody trusts anybody else. And it creates violence and it creates, you know, what you see basically in somewhere like Afghanistan. And so it's not a good thing. So it's very bad to be a man, I think. You don't have privilege being a man necessarily.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And to illustrate that point, I believe I had a screenshot on my computer here. I'll bring it up for the listening audience about male privilege. There we go. Let me just see if I can get that up for us here. Okay, there we go. So, male privilege, 97% of combat deaths, 76% of homicide victims, 93% of deaths in workplace accidents, 80% of the suicides, and 16% winners of custody. Okay,
in all species, the genetic diversity among men, because men are what we call fast life history strategists, and this means they're less adapted to the environment. They're more prone to just go for it, basically. And this means that they live fast and die young. And this means that there's less adaptation to the ecology. They're more genetically diverse. And what this means is that although the male and female IQ, for example, may be about the same, or maybe in adulthood males have an IQ advantage of about 2 points, small difference, the range of the male IQ is much larger. And this means that on the one hand, almost all geniuses and science Nobel Prize winners and people that do anything of great significance, really, you know, inventive, creative, highly intelligent people, will be men. But equally, the other extreme, the very, very low IQ people will be men.
Mm. And that's why men make up... A part of the reason why men have those huge achievements and that genius, that kind of thing, is because we're genetically driven for those high status positions, because we know it's going to get us laid. It's going to get us a good partner to choose from, that kind of thing. Women don't have to do that. They just let men do all the competing, and whoever comes out on top, that's who she gets on top of, you know.
That's true, but then there's a degree to which she has to compete with the other women.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not quite as simple as that. There's a, you know, the Anne Boleyn figure, for example. She actually, her descriptions are that she was good looking, but she wasn't perhaps conventionally good looking. But she had a certain charm to her. She's the kind of person you'd drop dead for if you met in real life. But if you saw her in a photograph, she wouldn't be that impressive, perhaps. Right? And so there's other tactics. But yeah, I think basically you're right. And also, I mean, we did a study on this actually. We got data on Nobel Prizes. Per capita science Nobel Prizes from various countries. And we kind of almost controlled for IQ. We looked only at countries with an IQ of above 90, which is 98% of countries that have ever won science Nobel Prizes. So we effectively controlled for intelligence. And then we got various testosterone markers at a national level. So we looked at the 2D40 ratio, so how big the difference is between the middle finger and the small finger. And if it's big, that's a feminine marker, it's a low testosterone marker. We looked at a number of sex partners in a lifetime. We looked at around the sex you have each week. We looked at the hairiness of the fingers. That's a testosterone marker. And we looked at various other markers. And we found that when you control for intelligence, it's clear that it's testosterone that's predicting how well you do. It was about 0.4 or something, the correlation. And I mean, I wanted to call the paper No Balls, No Nobel. Mm. But the academic journal rejected that title, the bloody snobs. You know, the British newspaper, The Sun, They reported it as No Balls, No Nobel, which I was quite pleased about.
Oh,
So absolutely, I think you're right. I think that there's men are this idea. There was a book published recently in England called The Sex Factor. It's by a woman called Victoria Bateman. Mm. I don't know if she's become famous in New Zealand, but she's a Cambridge academic who gets her kit off at conferences to draw attention to the lack of understanding of feminism or how bad Brexit is. Mm. Goes on TV naked with things written on her tits. And it strikes me that she argues some fallacious argument that makes no sense, that Japan and China were ahead of us, and then we liberated women, and then we became great, so therefore women are behind all the great things that have ever been done. Absolute sort of post hoc ergo prompt hoc nonsense. And you could argue the opposite. You could argue that it's actually patriarchy that creates a civilization, because if there's no patriarchy, there's no investment in women, and so there's no cooperation, there's nothing like that. And so that's what you get among, like, those primitive tribes. Women are equal to men, basically, in these tribes. There's no women walk around naked, there's no whatever, and men invest very little in their children and invest very little in anybody else and trust everybody else very little because they might shag their wives and whatever. And it's not a society that does well. Once the man starts investing in the woman and you bring in patriarchy, and you control the women so the men can be confident that their babies are theirs, then they will invest in the female and the child, and they will stop fighting with the other men, and they will cooperate with the other men, and so they'll be more ethnocentric. And so it could be argued that actually it's patriarchy that's behind civilization, and indeed it's lack of patriarchy that's killing it. I mean, evidently, if we abolished higher education for women, then IQ to a certain degree wouldn't be going down, would it?
Yes,
it's clearly
indeed.
Higher education. So that would be...
The statistics within male-dominated fields, programmers, builders, construction, basically... Ladies and gentlemen, if you are using a piece of technology ever, or if that technology has ever broken down and you needed somebody to fix it, ever, there's like a 90%+ chance that that piece of technology was both invented by a man and is going to be fixed by a man. Ergo, if you disparage any concept of patriarchy and you say, nah, men are all bad, or that kind of thing, what you're going to do is you're going to ensure a society where nothing gets built And if anything gets broken, nothing gets fixed. In fact, there was a famous feminist who once said that if women had been in charge of society this whole time, we'd all still be living in grass huts.
And they'd like it like that, because these kinds of societies tend to be, low stress. Women are high in neuroticism. They worry more easily. They're high in anxiety. And if you live on a very hot place and you can just pick food off the trees, you know, there's not much stress. You haven't got to worry. And there's no change. But no, it doesn't. Yeah, you're quite right. It doesn't work like that. It is basically high outlier high IQ. Men have more per capita people without more, as a percentage, have outlier high IQ. Plus, basically, elements of psychopathic personality. Basically, a very high IQ criminal. That's what a genius is.
Mm.
Low IQ, and he's just a criminal. And women just don't have this. Their outlier levels are too low, and their level of kindness and niceness, not wanting to offend people, and their level of rule following, and thus not thinking outside the box, is just too low. So they don't come up with these things. It's just, what else can you say? I mean, there's nothing, there are things that women are good at. I mean, if you were a kid and you were upset, you want to go to your mum. Why? Because your mum is higher in empathy. She's higher in altruism. She's probably higher in self-control, less likely to lose her temper. And so it's very important. And that, of course, they are, because women that are like that are better at raising children. And so their children are more likely to survive in prehistory. And so those genes for women to be like that were passed on. If you wanted your bike fixed or you want whatever, you probably go to your dad. And this in society, and also women tend to marry hypergamously. And most people, it's not always the case, but most people, it's the father often is more educated and earns more than the mother. Mm. I was in a meeting tonight, it's very interesting, of British people in Oulu in northern Finland, where I live, because we're Brexit and so on. And so a lot of people are quite concerned about what our rights are going to be in Finland. And so there was this meeting, and it was packed in this restaurant, and the ambassador was there. And it was maybe there was about 30 or 40 people of these British people. And I think two were women. And that makes sense, because women sexually select for status, and being British has a definite status in this country. It's literally sexually attractive to be British in a way that it isn't to be a country that's poorer than Finland, like I don't know, Estonia or Thailand. And we did a study on this. We got every single multicultural marriage in Finland in the year 2013. And we charted how rich the country was. And we found that on average, the women married men from countries that were richer than Finland, and the Finnish men married women from countries that were poorer than Finland. And that's exactly what evolution would predict, because men aren't interested in status and women are.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And this concept that's been floating around now, as I mentioned before, the white privilege, male privilege or whatever, it's just trying to divide us so that we can't survive, more or less. Or at least that's how it sort of looks to me. If I see a society where men aren't men anymore, women aren't women anymore, and in fact the roles that we have are confused, that society is fucking doomed, period.
Indeed. In Oulu, there have been since August 29 cases of Muslim refugees gang raping girls between the ages of 10 and 15. Now, there's an asylum centre in Oulu, you see. Now, good God, the police tried to hush this up. The newspapers didn't report it. And it was down to basically a citizen journalist called Yunus Locker, who is a councillor here, a nationalist councillor, and his fiancée. To uncover this and work out what was going on and bring the country's attention to it. And we had then the Prime Minister here saying how awful this was. The very Prime Minister who opened the floodgates in 2015 to 32,000 of these refugees, some of whom were the rapists. Now, you would expect, it could be argued that in Russia or something, if that happened, people would just go out and find these people and just kill them. I mean, there'd be no holds barred. I mean, there'd be absolute riot. But here, people are so, and not in other Western countries, people are so kind of demasculinized. It's so that you don't fight at school, you tell the teacher, and you don't, there is a reaction, of course, but it's not as strong a reaction as you might predict. Whereas these people who are coming here, they are high in asabiyah, and they are manly. They are manly men. And so you can see the... And there's a wonderful Norwegian joke commercial about life in Sweden or something. And there's this typical multiculturalist there with his girlfriend, and these Arabs come up to him in the bar and just start groping her and hitting her and stuff, and then beating him up. And he goes, oh, yeah, multicultural society. Oh, it's so wonderful. And this is the I'm afraid, the point that it's out with some people. They have a death wish. And that's what societies in decline have. They have this maladaptive ideas. They're too nice, and they lose these martial values. These martial values that allow them to win the battle of group selection, the positive and negative ethnocentrism. I was watching that. What's that fellow? He's New Zealander as well. A lot of interesting New Zealanders. That was the director of Lord of the Rings,
Peter Jackson.
Yeah, brilliant. And he did this brilliant documentary called "They Shall Not Grow Old," and he colorized World War One video footage. And then he got lip readers to work out what the people had said and to work out from the regiment roughly where they were from, and thus to give voice to these people, literally, wow. They're saying, like, all right, what do you want? And it was an absolutely extraordinary, haunting thing. But that these people were prepared, these young men, sometimes they were as young as 14, were prepared to go and join up and potentially lay down their lives for their country, and did do so. And 8% of those that went out were killed, and about 16% of the officers were killed. Which, of course, is going to have a effect on intelligence, because the officers will tend to be more intelligent. And it's extraordinary. Do you think you could do that now? If we went to war with the country now, you could get that kind of ethnocentric reaction. Of course, you couldn't. And part of it is religion. Part of it is this childhood. What can we call it? Inculcation with martial values, to put it in a euphemistic way. But basically, it's kind of violence, really, to some extent. If you talk to most people of your grandparents' generation, their overwhelming memory of school is kind of fear. We couldn't do it now. So I think this is a very serious issue that we have to confront.
That's right. I think I was watching a video by 42 last night, and he was talking about is masculinity bad? And one point he made was particularly interesting, is that if a bad man is trying to rape you or something like that, who do you think's going to stop them other than a good man? All right. So you say all men are bad or whatever, but who are you going to call for help when a bad man's attacking you? It's generally going to be a different man, one who's not bad or whatever. So the concept of thinking that masculinity in and of itself is simply just a bad thing or whatever it's not only insane, it's fucking suicidal.
Because it's suicidal. Are you familiar with Mouse Utopia? So there was an experiment.
They had a whole bunch of mice in one particular area, and they had all the food that they wanted, all the comfort that they wanted, and instead of being fighting with each other for dominance and things like that, they became lazy, they became fat, they became obsessed with how they looked, and obsessive cleaning.
But it kind of eerily paralleled the Industrial Revolution. So first of all, once they'd established hierarchies, then there was a massive spike in population, just like happened in the 19th century, because all these babies that would have been killed off weren't killed off, and they were able to pass on their genes and whatever. So you have a massive spike in population. Then the population growth still continues, but it starts to slow down, like you see in Western countries, in the 50s or whatever, suddenly people are having 2.4 children or whatever. The growth starts to slow down. And then eventually the growth kind of stops, it kind of reaches a plateau, it stops growing. And when this happens, they start noticing these interesting things. They start noticing that the women are becoming more masculine, a lot of female mice are becoming more masculinized, they're throwing the young out of the nest too young, so they can't socialize properly, they're attacking their own young, they're doing these weird things. And then they notice, as you pointed out, the group known as the beautiful ones, who are these increasingly effeminate men who aren't interested in fighting and aren't interested in getting territory and just kind of group around together. They huddle, which is also weird behavior, because mice aren't particularly, they are pack animals, but they're not particularly sociable. There's a massive amount of space, but they were huddling together. And these beautiful ones would just groom each other and whatever. They'd never been in fights from autopsies. There were never any cuts on them. And they weren't interested in sex, a bit like in Japan. The women had to pester them for sex and things, and they weren't interested. And eventually, pretty much all of them. And then all the males started to be less interested in sex. They weren't all beautiful ones, but they were much less interested in sex. The females were all aggressive, and nobody had any children, and the colony died out. And the way that you can interpret this is what we're talking about with spiteful mutations, that you have these beautiful ones are literally affecting the behavior of the superorganism, as are these mothers. And it's just ballsing up the equilibrium. People aren't learning to be, as it were, martialized mice. They're not learning social skills properly because they're thrown out of the nest too young. They're not learning to fight. And so they just collapse. Imagine what would happen if you let some wild mice into that into that experiment. What
they'd
do you think
fucking take over. They'd destroy they'd destroy everything they didn't like.
Indeed.
This is what the socialists call normalizing. First, you infiltrate a country, you debase its morality, then once its morality is completely debased and it's in a state of constant crisis, then they will accept invasion as a savior, and right then, that's when they say, we're going to normalize everything, i.e. take over for ourselves.
Now, I have some...
What's interesting here, though, is we talked about the beautiful ones, the mice and everything like that. Now, that experiment happened right before, I believe, the institution of the projects in the United States, housing projects for black Americans and stuff like that. And they found that exactly what they did to the mice is exactly what happened to the black communities who went into those big housing projects and things like that. And some believe that that was a deliberate act to try and destroy the black communities, which at that time were very strong, very politically active. They had, you know, people like Malcolm X and so on and so forth don't fucking exist anymore.
No, no. The leaders are this Ortez woman. And
rappers who talk about sex and drugs all the time and that kind of thing. And that's partially deliberate too, because the music industry, I think it was back in 1980s, Professor Griff from Public Enemy was talking hugely about this, that the record companies were indeed encouraging them to only talk about these things. It wasn't that it was never part of the rap and all of that kind of thing. It was more the fact that stay away from politics, stay away from things that are important, stay away from morality, that kind of thing, and as a result, people will always, generally speaking, look up to their idols. And if you're a black kid and you're in a bad situation, and your idol is talking about money and drugs and guns and sex and all of that kind of stuff, rather than chivalry or those kind of qualities, you would destroy the corresponding society. And it has been.
I think you might be. I have to say, I'm not as familiar with that as I could be, but it's very interesting that the percentage of the American population that is black is about 12% now, and it's been about 12% for a very long time. Whereas the percentage, of course, that is, as it were, motivated, the Hispanics and so on, goes up and up and up and up and up. And so one starts to wonder if they are a kind of, in that sense, a demasculine. Yeah, I think. I mean, think about the fact that. When was it exactly? 17-something, you had the Nat Turner Rebellion on these slave plantations. I mean, the conditions they were in were so appalling. But compared, I suppose, to the white people, the conditions of natural selection they were under were obviously higher. I mean, the selection for, being able to get on with other black people so they look out for you and make sure you don't get whipped or whatever, these kinds of things. The selection is going to be high, and they've no access to medicine. They've got to get on with each other at the weekends and all this kind of at the Sunday when they don't work and all this. And so he managed to lead this rebellion. I mean, okay, it was crushed in the end, but it was, and then in Haiti, it was basically successful, against such powerful opposition. So it was quite extraordinary what they were able to do at that time, considering that they were actually literally bondsmen, literally slaves. It was a very amazing achievement.
At that time, they created a new definition of a mental illness to say that people who didn't want to be slaves were mentally ill. Like there was something wrong with them. Why wouldn't you want to be a slave?
how very convenient, because interestingly, of course, it was argued in the 60s that the people who were conservative, the authoritarian mind, were mentally ill. People that had any kind of ethnocentric nationalistic value were basically pathological. And it's a very common tactic to dismiss your enemies as mental not just mental, but of low status and whatever, but particularly as being mentally unstable, and so to deal with them that way, as conspiracy theorists, as mad. You know. I didn't know
heretic.
That. As a heretic, well, perhaps as a, although a lot of the heretic, well, yes, yeah, perhaps as a heretic, perhaps as a heretic. Although it should be emphasised that a lot of heretics were themselves happy to burn other heretics when they were themselves not heretics.
Yeah.
When they were in charge. But I'd like to stress that I'm one of them. Yeah, yeah. So I wouldn't burn anybody. But, and this really irritated me. But it's, it made a highly, highly fallacious argument that wasn't based on empirical evidence. Then I feel that perhaps burning is appropriate. But you should strangle them first. But I'm not really cruel. But no, I'm seriously. I think we've got to stand up against this. I think because it's anti reason. And if you base public policy around fallacies, then you're going to around things that are untrue. Then you're going to have serious problems. And this is what we do. We base things around this idea of everyone's equal, and therefore, what's going on? How can we solve this? But the point is, of course, people aren't all equal. I'm not equal to you. I'm sure there are things you're better at than me. And I'm sure there are things that I'm better at than you, and no one's equal, and it would be a very dull world if we all were. Yeah. But that also is true, I'm afraid, at the group level. But of course it is, and it's true. But what's happening is we're getting less intelligent. We're getting less intelligent. Because how old are you, if you don't mind my asking?
34.
You're 34. Do you have children?
Not yet.
No, not yet. And if you think about our parents' generation, I mean, I'm 4 years older than you, but they often had children. I mean, my mother had me at 26, and that was perfectly normal. And if you go back to the previous generation, it was younger, and this was perfectly normal. And people would have these kids, and people, they leave it late, and particularly if they're men, if they leave it over 35, then they're more likely to have mutant semen and kids with autism and things. So get on with it. What was his name? The guy that was the Prime Minister of Singapore, Kwan Tang Yu or something like this. And there was, and he was at a meeting, and he said, this girl said to him, "Oh, I'm a 26-year-old PhD student. What advice would you have for me?" And he just said, "Are you married?" And she's like, "Do you have children?" She's like, "No." "Are you married?" "No." "Do you have a boyfriend?" "Well, yeah." And he just goes, "Well, this is the problem. That people like you spend your 20s and maybe even your 30s dedicated to your careers, and then you want to have children, and you don't have many. It's too late. So I think it's great you're doing your PhD. Do your PhD and your boyfriend." And you know, it's a very significant issue. If you're watching this and you're highly intelligent, which you most certainly are, I should think, you've got to have more kids. But then I'm a hypocrite. I've got only two kids, because you've got to think to yourself, if you've got three kids, you need a bigger car. You know, and that's what people who are reasonably bright do. They rationalize these things. Could I afford this house? And then they rationalise these things. And if God isn't there telling them to have lots of kids, which I'm afraid he's not, then, for me anyway, then maybe I should get done for cannabis or something, and the police could come, and then he'll tell me to do that. But like with you, it's the future becomes this possibility of collapse, of us going backwards, of Darwinian selection reinstituting itself, but then of course of something coming out of the ashes. Of some kind of civilization rising again. And this begs the question of what can we do? Can we slow it down, the decline? Perhaps so.
I think Mark Passio, probably more than any others, has sort of touched on the solution to this, and that is to teach occultism to the average person. Now, what occultism is, it's not, you know, devils and that kind of stuff. It's this. There are only two people in the world. You are one of them, I'm one of them. What kind of laws would make right or wrong out of that? So, for instance, I want to smoke cannabis, you don't like it. Is it right for you to tell me that I can't have it? No, obvious. All right. So that's how natural law works. If you reduce the entire scale of the world down to two people, and one does one thing to the other, is it right or is it wrong? And that's essentially what he was saying, is that because the aggregate morality of society has waned so much, the effect on society and how it behaves will reflect their morality. Now, if we, on the other hand, taught those very, very strong principles, cause and effect, natural law, and things of that nature to society in the aggregate, then freedom would increase, whereas morality decreases. increases, freedom decreases as well.
But if you think about what we were talking about earlier, like patriarchy and so on, and how patriarchy helps to develop highly cooperative societies, you end up with questions like, is it wrong in Somalia to cut off a girl's clitoris and then sew her up with a tiny hole the size of a match head to urinate through? Now, yeah, on a certain individual moral level, obviously it's wrong. But on the level of the group and what it does for the group, it means that men can be more sure that they will not be cuckolded. It means that fathers will have more of a motivation to invest in their daughters. It means that women are more protected and less likely to be raped. It means there's less conflict in the society. And it means, therefore, basically higher ethnocentrism, positive and negative.
Sure, so you have but however, wrong. Marriage and
sure,
monogamy...
it's despicable, it's vile, but at the level of the group, it's doing something good. Equally with these public schools, beating children on their bare buttocks with birches, of course it's appalling, but at the level of the group, is it doing something good? So that's what I sort of wonder about, really.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. As you say, if the group is the only thing that has any rights, then none of the individuals have any rights, okay? That's socialism, that's communitarianism, this is a terrible thing.
And
of course, every time a society has ever adopted the whole idea of communitarianism over individualism, those societies have collapsed and destroyed and or not progressed very far. So you'd have these societies, like say in Somalia or whatever, where you have that clitoris being cut off of the woman and all of this kind of stuff. How far has that society gotten? Whereas
Japan and China are highly communitarian.
Ah, but
and China,
do they?
China would bind the feet of women and this kind of thing. And there are various cruel things that we did, the Europeans did to each other, beating, as I said, which is something that wasn't as prevalent, by the way, in places like, I've done research into this, it wasn't as prevalent in places like Somalia or India, this systematic flogging of children. You know, you don't get this. And you get this in until the previous generation in England, or certainly at public schools. So I'm not 100% sure about that. I think there's probably an optimum balance in terms of the environmental component to, let's say, genius. Something like genius. Like, if you're too communitarian, then these people will be have their spirit broken by the public school system, and they will be taught not to think, basically, and they won't, that environmental aspect won't be there, and it will damage their prospect of coming up with a highly original idea. So that's bad. If you're not communitarian enough, then probably their level of discipline will be so low that the incentive won't be there to come up with things. And also, if you're not very communitarian, you'll create a chaotic society where everyone's fighting and so on, no one's cooperating, and that won't help a wealth, and that won't help optimum nutrition, and that won't help the genius to come up with good ideas. So there has to be some sort of optimum level. And I suspect that we reached that circa 1850, when we were at our maximum per capita level of geniuses. And since then, for genetic and concomitant, as you've pointed out many times, environmental reasons, we've become suboptimal, and increasingly suboptimal. So,
Well, indeed, as we were talking before about the progress in society that's made by just having monogamy, you know, one man for one woman and that kind of thing, it seems to have positive onflow effects without any victimization. And that seems kind of like the ideal compromise. You can't, it's like, gentlemen, you can look, but you can't touch, okay? Because that's what you got to do. You got to make sure that you are of value to society, that you honor your word, you do all of these good things that are traditionally male roles, okay? So if somebody is invading your country, if somebody's like brutally oppressing you or something like that, it's that inherent maleness that would be the thing that would solve that problem, that would go and destroy, that would kill. Our aggression and things of that nature have turned into, I don't know, like a bad word, but in actual fact, it's the reason why we're capable of defending our tribes from ancient times up until now. And this concept that everybody's equal is so fucking stupid that I can't even believe it, because I can give people a solid example. Here's two people. Okay, one of them is a firefighter, and he just carried down a woman from a burning building. Right next to him is another guy and he's the arsonist who set that building on fire. Now, which of those two people do you think has more value? It's pretty obvious. It's the firefighter, the guy who saves lives, the guy who does a job.
And only that firefighter will almost certainly be higher in intelligence and higher in mental stability.
Well,
so he'll have the genes that we want, whereas the arsonist will be mentally unstable and probably low IQ. So, particularly if he's so stupid that he hasn't run away and he's just standing there. So, I think you're quite right about that. In terms of value, a firefighter obviously has great value. And I must stress this, there's much more to life than intelligence. And I made that remark earlier about firefighters or whatever. If any firefighters listening to this, I'm not suggesting you're thick or something. I'm just saying it is average intelligence. And there are many advantages to that. And indeed, people who have very high IQ, it's often a very bad thing. Because, first of all, the positive manifold between the different aspects of intelligence becomes weaker at high levels, which means that you're crap at social skill or driving a car or whatever. And also, because intelligence is about solving problems, the more information you can take in, the more you're better to solve the problem, so the more intelligent you'll be. And this makes highly intelligent people, have autistic-like traits. They're highly sensitive to noise. They hate change. It really is awful for a lot of these people. And they end up depressed. And also there's very few people they can get on with because they're so more intelligent than other people. So they come across as weird to most people. And they basically just have a rotten life. But there's a degree to which they're not operating at the individual. Often they don't have children as well. But they're operating at the group level. They're doing something that's good for the group. So is the fireman, of course. But the fireman will also probably pass on his genes because women like men in uniform. But and strong men and men who are tall, I think this is a very important. But we have become, as I didn't know I was going to get talking about this tonight. It's got absolutely nothing to do with my book, although it has got a lot to do with the book I'm writing at the moment on this very subject of masculinity. I'll probably finish it in a year or so. But yeah, it's we have been demasculinized, and this is along with the high IQ weaponized against us. Is causing severe problems. But then worse, that's the near future. The far future is that we're getting less intelligent, and this will result in the collapse, the going backwards of civilization and Darwinian conditions being, to a certain extent, reinstituted. So then what can we do? Do you have a system of eugenics? This is what a lot of people that post on my Jolly Heretic suggest.
Kevin Murgo Galilee, he's written about 20 books about the covert depopulation agenda of the United Nations. He's been on, what, did I say 20 books? No, I think he's written about maybe 6 books on that topic, but he's done 20 hunger strikes, including in front of the Vatican and things of that nature. Now, what he proposes is that instead of adding fluoride in the water as a spermicide and putting genetic destructors in all the food and things like that to curb the population growth covertly by basically destroying sperm count, destroying fertility in the aggregate, he thinks that, in fact, we should be into a more informed and overt form of population control where people really do take control of what they're doing themselves and try not to have children. But, of course, you've raised some important points here that throws that entire system out of whack, because you wouldn't be able to have people with the low IQs taking up contraception voluntarily and intelligently and making conscientious decisions. So that aspect of eugenics that you're talking about seems to sort of make a bit more sense, but at the same time, that's immoral. And so we haven't come up with any kind of solution to this. We've got bad alternatives, and that is all we have.
Well, there's other things. I mean, if you argue that we're an aging society, if you're aging, let's say you're past your prime, you're in your 50s, I don't know, you can do things to make your decline better or worse. You can do things to put off your decline, to make it longer, right? So that you haven't got high morbidity, so that you're not unhealthy, so that you can walk. And so that you can live longer and enjoy perhaps great grandchildren. You can make choices in your you can give up smoking, let's say, in your 50s, or you can lose a load of weight to avoid the development of diabetes, which will take 10 years off your life, or whatever. You can do all kinds of things. And it could be argued that as a society, as it were, that's past its prime in terms of our intelligence. We've got this kind of this capital that we've built up, so we can just make minor tinkering with it, and you know, living standards continue to increase on certain measures. But eventually, that capital will, there'll be less and less minor inventions, and that's provable. There's less and less major inventions. Eventually, we start eating into the capital, like old people do, right? When they're a pensioner. And so we can postpone eating into the capital by these various things. And that's what we should think about doing. So it's not all doom and gloom in that way. In terms of the society being invaded, that's a bad thing. It'll probably happen eventually, but it can certainly be postponed.
Well, I think that invasion's already happening as recent immigration policy is essentially we're inviting invasion, more or less. We're inviting social disorder.
You act against it. And one of the things which is happening as a consequence of social media is that people are realizing the degree to which they're being basically lied to by the mainstream media. And so it's and not just mainstream media, but the politicians and the police. And so you end up with a situation of a more disunited society, of a society where people aren't watching the same things on telly every day, they're not reading the same newspapers, and so there's a growing portion who are seeing what's happening and will act accordingly. And once that portion grows to above a certain level, some in a certain institution, some people argue it's 10%, some people argue it's 25%, if they're particularly rowdy, then they can start to change minds. And perhaps that's happening, because when I came to Finland in 2005, Tony Blair was in charge. The idea of even talking about any of these things, the pressure was so strong that to not even discuss these things. And now look where we are. These kinds of things are being, certainly in Britain, these kinds of problems are being openly discussed. So it's things can change in the short term in a direction which is conducive to a slower decline, or happier old age, perhaps. So it's the book isn't all doom and gloom in that way. I mean, I'm very open if anyone wants to come correspond with me about a better solution. I'm too stupid to think of one, but I can't think of one. I can't think of a solution to this problem other than that we continue the cycle of civilization that there's always been.
That's about the point that I was just about to make, is that people like you or I who notice the trends in society over a long period of time, eventually we give up on trying to stop the cycles because we realize that they're inevitable. Is that what's happening to us?
There could be argued that's the case, but on the other hand, it could be argued that the kind of people who challenge the current dispensation, as it were, tend to be relatively intelligent people who are relatively high in testosterone. And so they have a degree of, I don't know if I'm high in testosterone, on some physical measures I am, on some I'm not, but those, on average, that's what those people are like. And those people don't give up. They don't give up. And that's the thing with geniuses. They will, well, I'm saying I'm a genius or you are, but the extreme manifestation of this, outlier high IQ plus disagreeable personality, you know, high testosterone, those people will work on a problem obsessively for years and years and years and years and years and years. And they're highly competitive as well. Often they're aware that other people are working on the problem. We must do it first. We must beat Amundsen and make it to the South Pole first. We must, you know. So they don't give up, even in the face of the most appalling odds. They don't give up. So even though we know it's a cycle, or we think we know, we don't give up. That's the thing.
Well, sure. I mean, is that just folly, though? Because surely other intelligent men throughout the entirety of history have decried its decline and yet seen it in front of them crumble anyway. The reason why I'm saying this is because reality is not a nice thing. Truth is not something that makes you feel good. Usually it'll motivate you to do something different with your life. That's the meaning of the word controversy. The conversation that we've had could, in fact, be interpreted as a conversation, a controversial conversation. And what the word controversy means is you are confronted with a truth that will force you to change how you live your life. Now,
I mean, all. Sorry.
Is there a possibility that we now have the technology and the intelligence where we could, for the first time in history, reverse this cycle of getting dumber, destroying society, and then eventually... Well, there's this old historical phrase, which is, good times create weak men. Weak men create chaotic times. Chaotic times create strong men, and strong men create ordered times.
Yes, I think that we did. I mean, the Malthusian cycle was this idea that this rise and fall, and you'd the population would rise, there'd be too many people for the land, there'd be a famine, population would fall again. That's the Malthusian cycle, right? We broke free of this with the Industrial Revolution. As far as I can see, the reason we did was various things that had made our intelligence very high, which we look at in the book, executing all of our criminals, and it being very cold in the morning minimum, and obviously this selection for intelligence that was going on. But also, we were very, very religious, much more religious than previous societies. And we'd inherited Christianity at a time when it had a Jewish taboo on contraception. We inherited that, and this meant that we had to become much, much more intelligent, basically, and much, much less religious before we broke the taboo, as it were. And that's what allowed us to get past the Industrial Revolution and then develop contraception, rather than develop contraception on the cusp of it. That's a theory put forward by my colleague Gerhard Meisenberg, and it's a very good theory. Mm-hmm. So it's, I suppose, possible that there's something else that we could develop. In theory, it's possible that could keep it going, that could change the situation, and that could cause our intelligence to start to rise. But it may be that there's a biological limit on how intelligent we can ever be. And it could be argued that there are actually bad things to societies being too intelligent. Because once you're highly intelligent, you're less instinctive, and these instincts include things like nationalism and the genetic preservation and desiring to have children. You're more interested in ideas and so on. As we discussed earlier, if you're very high IQ, you're kind of autistic, a very, very high level of intelligence. And so this will mess you up. And so it could be that there's an optimum level of intelligence. And if we go beyond it, the civilization collapses. And that's what keeps the species alive. The species has to work like that. If it gets too intelligent, it's fucked. And that's why there'll always be something that will prevent it. Normally contraception. But due to unique circumstances in our cycle of civilization, we've got a bit further. But there has to be something to stop us getting too intelligent, because he's not good to be too intelligent.
Yeah.
There are bad sides to it at the individual level, and probably at the group, certainly I think at the group level, in the absence of other factors. Because if you're too intelligent, you know.
Well, that occurs to me then, dumbing down the population deliberately would be seen by some as a rational response. I mean, let's say if having too high intelligence was in fact a danger to society, then certain people would go, well, let's just dumb down the population. Let's dumb down the education. Let's dumb down the entertainment.
Like organisms. I think it would be difficult for us to control this. It's a natural evolutionary process.
Well, what's problematic is that we now have technology that can essentially bypass simple biological processes. For example, I could yell as hard as I can and maybe my neighbours would hear something. But now I'm broadcasting to a whole bunch of people or whatever, so that's increasing the amplification of my voice. However, if I had tantamount control over the five companies that control pretty much every single media entity in the United States, and then I wanted to influence society, I could, on a mass scale, far more than I could just by yelling at my neighbours. So the degree of influence that we have through the development of our technologies has changed the game a little bit. We're not just genetic, we're not just psychological, we now are becoming technological, and this is what a lot of people are wanting to move into the post-human era, where we have chips and all of these kind of things. But what's problematic about that is that if you start augmenting the human body, there's a good chance, at least according to many, that you would lose your humanity in the process. And what good is progress if we lose who we are when we do it?
I mean, one problem with allowing people to select their own children is that women, they don't tend to select for intelligence. They select for extroversion. They see that the people that do well in society at the moment are the kind of X-factor twats, and that's who they select for. They want extrovert, outgoing men. So it would be disastrous to allow people to make these kinds of decisions, I think. You'd end up with a society of narcissists on a scale even higher than we're seeing at the moment. You end up with a society of the X Factor kind of person, you know, the guy that's full of shit that you meet down the pub that boasts. And that would be awful. So I'd be very concerned. I'd be very concerned about letting people select their own children, or select. And also, these machines, once we invent them, have to be maintained. And as we get less intelligent, we'll be less able to maintain them, and less able to fix them. In our case, we could invent people that robots that could fix themselves. And then it gets to a point where, unfortunately, you may well be in a kind of situation where they take the view that the thing that has created them. This is a waste of time. It's just stupid. They won't be able to believe the lack of logic and the you know. And so perhaps that would be the end of us. So I don't. We're going into questions now, which are way beyond anything I've thought about recently.
Well, that's
but it's certainly very.
Don't worry. You're not expected to know everything.
Sorry. It's late here.
I understand. And in fact, we're 10 minutes over the time of the allotted broadcast already.
Oh God.
So. How about we try and round it off nicely, tie it up in a neat little bow for the audience.
That's a very good Jack. That's much better than my Shakespeare's beard. That's very, very good.
Yes.
Although some New Zealanders have accents that are so English sounding, you'd think they were English. So it's sort of a softer accent than Australia, isn't it? Much softer.
Yeah. Much well, you can tell the difference if you ask for a pin or a pen. All right, because in Australia, it's the same word. It's a pen.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for watching this little broadcast today. And I do want to encourage you, ladies and gentlemen, if you've got any money for me, okay, this is the reason why I asked for the donations right at the end of the broadcast, because you have already been given everything of value that you want to take from me, and only now do you have a choice. Whether or not you want to pay for that, whether or not you want to see shows like this continue into the future. That way you're not making an economical decision where you benefit from it or whatever. You're making a compassionate decision where I am the beneficiary and you've already received everything I can possibly give you. So ladies and gentlemen, please go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question. And Eastwood, like, go ahead. Make my news and start up an automatic payment today, whether through PayPal, Kiwi Bank, or if you want to become a Patreon, they charge out monthly. In fact, they're going to be charging out tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen. I want to thank you for all of your support, all of you who have been liking this broadcast, all of the people in the chat room, Blistic, Iman, JJ, Scowling, everybody. Thank you so much for being there during this broadcast. Now, lastly, I just want to pop it back over to our wonderful guest. If you've got some final parting words for the audience, perhaps words of wisdom they can take away from them of value.
Do subscribe to my Jolly Heretic YouTube page. I do a video once a week, and if you like the book, The Idea of What We're Talking About, At Our Wit's End, buy the book. But most importantly, if you're highly intelligent, you're watching this, you need to have more unprotected sex, and that will at least slow down the process. I know in New Zealand it's now, what time is it now, about 11 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah.
On a school day, so, you know, later on. But that's the only thing I can think of as a solution, and it's not a good solution. But anyway, yes, love, not war.
Indeed. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. This has been edwarddutton.wordpress.com is his website, The Jolly Heretic on YouTube. And again, lastly, ladies and gentlemen, thanks very much for watching. Thanks for sharing the show, liking it, and giving the donations, and any kind of support that you have is greatly appreciated, because we don't have any choice, ladies and gentlemen, but to do the right thing, because our society is so fucked right now that if we do not, we may not have a society for our future generations to enjoy. Thank you very much, and we'll see you again sometime.